Hello, I'm Eric Topol, Editor-in-Chief of Medscape, and I have a really delightful chance today to interview Vinod Khosla. Vinod is the person who set up Khosla Ventures, one of the most successful venture capital firms in the world many years ago, and has a really interesting background. So Vinod, I think you started out with your engineering background first in India, one of the most prestigious institutes of technology, Carnegie Mellon, Stanford. Is that the right?
That's the right sequence.
Okay. And engineering wasn't where you landed long term, because then you, some point along the way, you started Sun Microsystems, right?
Yes. So when I started, there wasn't a thing called computer science. Tells you how old I am, but I did learn to use punch cards. In those days, you could sort of pursue any new area if you created your own program, because there was not a lot of programs. So at IIT, we started the computer science programming effort. It wasn't a program. And then did some biomedical engineering, because it was pretty close to electrical engineering. And went on to get a master's in Carnegie Mellon in biomedical engineering. And that was also a small, tiny little program in the basement, so I can't keep my attention on one thing.
Well, when you started Sun, and that turned out to be one of the four horsemen of the internet, did you know where that was headed? I mean, that's pretty extraordinary.
Well, we were pretty excited about the idea of distributed computing. That was a fundamentally new idea, and it's funny in retrospect. The networking piece is the one piece that nobody wanted. So we kept getting requests to delete it.
Wow.
Almost like it's the data piece that nobody wants in medicine now.
Wow.
When you start things, it's really, you know, there are fundamental things that should be.
Yeah.
But you don't actually know how it'll play out. And that's what's interesting about all these new spaces. You do a lot of discovery. It's like playing video games and discovering new puzzles along the way to solve.
Well, you're pretty good at that. Now, before we get into your current efforts in changing medicine, there was a stretch after Sun that you were with Kleiner Perkins, mm-hmm. and so you've got really, I guess, your real experience in the venture world. And then what was it that made you decide, okay, I'm ready, I'm going to go on my own now?
Well, so I tend to follow what I'm interested in. I was a Kleiner for almost 20 years,
yeah,
and we were doing really cool stuff. But I wanted to do science experiments, really new things that hadn't been done before, where there wasn't a market. In healthcare, it'd be the equivalent saying there's no billing code for this or that equivalent, and say, what's just fundamentally new that should be valuable? And I started off doing science experiments of one sort or another in trying to address important areas, as opposed to saying what's a good business to start with. Yeah. And that's what led me to start my own firm, and it's led to all kinds of interesting things.
Actually, that's one of the things that I find most exceptional about you, is that not only, as we're going to now zoom in on healthcare, but you also have been putting so much effort, resources into things like energy and new ways to produce food. And you're thinking broadly. You kind of think at the planet level. It seems that way to me. I don't know.
You know, I don't think of myself that way. I love to think of large problems, because they're more fun to tackle. So wherever there's a large problem, I always find technology can be a huge solution. Technology is usually not sufficient, but it's absolutely necessary. And I view technology as the hard problem, and then the political problem I leave to others to solve. But I've found that for most really large problems, if you think out of the box enough, there's really interesting technology solutions. And that's what I always look at.
Okay. All right. Now, I think, well, we first got together because I know you're an avid reader, and you had read The Creative Destruction of Medicine, and And now I think we realized that a lot of our ideas were in alignment because you also were seeing this big disruption. And since that time now, we're...
This You're is just several, a better writer.
No, I don't know about that. But since that time, you've really been, shaking it up and getting behind many new exciting technologies. But one of the things I wanted to kind of set the record straight, you've been misconstrued about doctors. And, you know, they have these kind of quotes about... Costa says that doctors are all going to be replaced 80%, whatever. Let's get that, wrote a white paper on that. Let's get that level.
Look, fundamentally, the doctors spend a lot of time doing things that others can do for them. Today, there's things a doctor could do that you say a nurse should do that. Well, there's technology, like a doctor's assistant can then that do a whole lot of things that they do today. So my view is doctors should do the most human element of care, not everything that they do today. And a very large percentage of what they do can be done with technology, so they're free to do other things. No doctor spends enough time with the typical or the median patient. The median patient visit is so short.
7 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard numbers shorter than that. And in places like India, it's much worse.
Yeah, less than a minute. Yeah.
So we don't have enough of the resource that's critical, the human element of care. And I think that's what humans should do.
Okay. Well, and we want to get into first some of these tools, technologies. Mm-hmm. We want to get back to that at the end, which is where is medicine ultimately going to go? But so what are the things that you're involved in that you find the most exciting?
Yeah. So, I started in medicine with the fundamental idea that, medicine's better than it ever has been, right? Medicine today is better than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 40 years ago. So it's done pretty damn good. But it has been the practice of medicine, every stage we iterate the next small improvement. We've never rethought medicine. And I believe we're starting an era where we'll go from the practice of medicine to the science of medicine. Mm. And that science of medicine will be much more quantitative. Now, a patient won't get three different recommendations depending upon the physician they saw. They'll get the exact same recommendation. It'll be probabilistically the best recommendation for them.
And it'll come from a machine?
Well, it'll come from a machine, and it'll be very multidimensional. Part of the reason the practice of medicine needs to change is it was based on things we could measure a very, very long time ago, like 200 years ago. You could take somebody's pulse a long time ago. You could put a cuff around their sleeve and measure their blood pressure or measure their temperature. So these simple ideas evolved because it was the only thing technology could do. And on that base was built in a series of iterations. And we've gotten more sophisticated, and we can look for cell-free DNA in blood and look for cancer mutations. But by and large, it's been incremental improvements.
Right.
If you ask the question, and there's one other fundamental thing. Medicine's been based on symptoms, almost always.
Right.
Like, I feel something, I report those, then you go on a detective chase and you mostly come up with the right answers, mostly. If you rethink medicine and say, how would you do it again?
Yeah.
There's a few thousand metabolic pathways in the body. Every part of your body is doing some physiologic thing that could be measured. If you could measure all the things all the time, how would you diagnose people?
So you say that by digitizing a human being, this may in fact be a quicker, more efficient way of than dealing with subjective symptoms? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, but I'm going further.
Okay.
Now, there's no notion of you have diabetes or you don't, right? It's a continuum. your parameters get worse and worse. It's not like at one point, we just happen to declare it diabetes after a certain A1C3 or whatever metric you want to use. But it's a continuum of shifts. If we could track that continuum and say, we'll avoid it early, you detect all these things early, whether that's heart disease or diabetes or other things, especially in chronic disease, you detect it early. Look, infectious disease, we've done a lot to mostly solve. Chronic disease now is sort of a big part of what's left. So there's still plenty of fun things to infectious disease too. But cracking the body's parameters, you know, your engine temperature on your car is not a good or bad. Yeah, they put a red marker somewhere, but you know it's going up if it's going up.
Mm-hmm.
I think the human body needs to be built to be monitored that way, and we need to know what's going on.
Well, that's a pretty reasonable assertion, since we monitor our cars far better than our bodies. So we have a long ways to go just to catch up to that. Well, like,
you know, this pains me. There's maybe a few hundred sensors in your typical car and none in your body.
It's amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
A single ad shown to you on Facebook has way more computing power, like thousands of times more computing power applied to it than a $10,000 medical decision you have to make. It's like blows my mind. So while medicine has gotten much better than it ever has been, I think a quantum jump is possible.
Yes.
And we can go from reactive to proactive by monitoring all the symptoms.
Yeah.
You know, we should have those check engine lights.
Oh, sure, for all different systems of your body. Right. And, you know, that's absolutely true.
There's also a related thing that I see as a real opportunity. Like I said, we started with all the things we could monitor a few hundred years ago. Blood pressure, temperature, heart rate. There are thousands of things we can monitor. And I think one of the fundamental underlying bases of this new medicine will be starting to measure things humans don't know how to use. So if there's a pattern of expression of 19 genes that says chemotherapy will help or not in your cancer, that's not something a human can eyeball.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But data science can solve that problem and say your probability of benefiting from this is X. Well, so one of the things we have to admit is we have to collect data humans can't use, whether it's 3,000 proteomic markers or way more spectral data in your ECG or just a beautiful technology where from your voice, they can tell your PHQ-9 score. That's a fun one.
Yeah.
In fact, they're working with hospitals where if a patient calls in, they can tell the PHQ-9 score when they're talking about what's wrong with something else. So all this data that humans can't understand can be reduced to actionable things and lead to that check engine light very early.
Well, I'm sure you're right about this. I mean, eventually that's where we're going to head to. There's a lot of obstacles. The medical community isn't so high on change. And what do you think it's going to take to get this to actualize?
I'm a fan of Obamacare, but I actually think it sort of screwed up a few things. I actually thought all the uninsured would be perfect people to use all this stuff because they have no access to medicine.
Right.
Movements like this start at the fringes. Sometimes it's a fringe of somebody who has no other access to healthcare. In India, there's a lot of people. There's probably 500 million people that have never seen a doctor in their life. And that's a pretty good place to start with primary care or an oncologist specialist, AI system. Well, at the other end, there's expensive stuff, you know, the kinds of things that human longevity or Arewal or others are trying to do, that then starts to scale and become cheaper and becomes more accessible. So any fringe works to start from, you need to find that anchor. I think that's what will happen. no large change comes from an organization that's sort of at the center of the system for two reasons. One, they tend to think linearly, and two, they really don't have an incentive to cause disruption, because disruption sounds like a great word, but it's painful for some people.
Well,
you
especially
know, if you've been disrupted,
yeah.
It's not very
well,
fun.
Well, especially
to be
for the medical community, doesn't yeah. like to get
yeah,
you
but,
know,
but
shaken
let me,
out.
Let me give you an analogy.
Yeah.
You know, Walmart didn't change retail. Amazon did.
Yeah.
It made it pretty damn comfortable, uncomfortable for all the retailers. Boeing and Lockheed didn't change space. SpaceX did. General Motors and Volkswagen didn't change electric cars or self-driving cars. It was Waymo and Tesla.
Yeah.
I'm hard-pressed. NBC and CBS didn't change media. It was Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. So I'm hard-pressed to find one large change that came from an institutional source in that area. And if you do find one, tell me.
Well, I think those examples are really quite remarkable.
Why should
actually.
Healthcare be different?
I can't think
and
that it
And that's
would
why
be.
I think it'll start at the fringes. It'll feel small and interesting, but inconsequential to the bulk of healthcare, but it'll be small but exponentially growing.
Do you think it's going to be tech titans, or is it going to be insurers? Is it going to be the outcry of the public? Where will this really get gelled?
You know, one of the things about large change is very hard to predict.
Yeah.
You know, we started talking about Sun and distributed computing. It was obvious that distributed computing should happen, but what form it should take was not clear at all. I jokingly say, I have a presentation I did in 2004 on cell phones, right? And I called my presentation the device that used to be a phone. And people looked at it and said, what do you mean? It's a phone. And I said, what do you use a phone for? And they said, talking. And I said, what if 95% of the use of the device was not talking, but other things?
Yeah.
And they said, that can't be, right? And in fact, Nokia and Motorola went under because they insisted phones should have keypads because you use a phone for dialing a number.
Yeah.
Well, Apple imagined it differently. They never built a phone.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So they started with sort of like, how would I start to do a bunch of things that wasn't just talking? And I wrote a presentation then, and the idea that the device would be used not for talking, but other things, mostly navigation. You couldn't imagine that. GPS, Twitter, news sources was fundamentally right. But every single example I came up with of how it might be used was wrong.
Yeah.
So I was directionally right, but very embarrassingly wrong on the specifics. I suspect I'll be the same in healthcare.
Well, you know, it reminds me of one time early when I got to San Diego, I was at a conference where they were smartphones. It was Qualcomm. Somebody get up, this is the beginning of 07, and said, we're thinking about putting a camera on a smartphone. And people say, why would you want to do that? I mean, that's, people already have point-and-shoot cameras. Yeah. But what you're getting at is when you have a fresh start, which, you know, is hard, of course, in the healthcare world. But there's another topic you alluded to.
And by the way, keep in mind, today most phones have two, and people are talking about many more cameras.
Yeah, exactly.
In
exactly.
fact, the latest iPhone has this sort of sensor, which is really a camera to detect your face.
Right.
It's the third camera. And there may be a dozen, because you want a 3D map. In
sure.
fact, the new iPhone thing is a laser-based thing that actually maps your face.
Oh, no. And
it's like mind-blowing to take.
It is. And the fact that it'll be doing that to every person you might come across mm-hmm. with augmented reality over time. But the thing you touched on that a lot of people are concerned about as we get into these advanced technologies, we're going to, you know, land on AI in a second, but that we then will make the inequities worse, that there are already very serious problems with gaps. Are you concerned of that? I mean, you understand the bigger
picture.
I'm
very concerned about that,
yeah.
And AI is especially going to be a driver of that. So in 2014, I wrote a piece for Forbes called, We Will Have Great GDP Growth, Great Abundance and Increasing Income Disparity. So that was roughly the title of a very long 5,000-word essay. I tend to write too much. I do think we are reaching a point where many of the things that require human decision-making, not human caring, but human decision-making, will be done better by machines.
Right.
So today it's obvious in radiology, the sensitivity and specificity, the accuracy with which a machine can read an MRI or a CT scan or an X-ray is way more better than a human can.
Sure.
And frankly, it's sort of criminal to have radiologists be doing this because in the process, they're killing people. It's very, very important that we realize that.
And that hasn't been tapped yet, really.
No,
it's been written up in papers, but it isn't the practice.
And in fact, 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk at the National Bureau of Economic Research meeting, and I took the top 20 employment categories in the U.S. and said, will most of the jobs in most of these categories be replaced by AI? And the answer was very clearly yes. Now, hard to predict timelines. It's probably not 10 years. It's much longer than that.
Right.
But is it 20 or 40 or 50? It's very hard to speculate. But directionally, you're right. And I think the single largest problem we will face is income disparity. And disparity of resources. Now, there's good news to come with that. The good news is if we have great abundance, people may not have a lot of income, but a personal AI physician to answer their questions, that'll be free.
Yeah.
Well, right? Just like Google Maps is free.
Absolutely. No, right? I think that fact that you can make that available universally is going to be extraordinary. Now, you mentioned about how with deep learning, we can do scans, we can do skin lesions, cancer, or diabetic retinopathy, and on and on and on. So this is obviously really getting legs. So then you fast forward, where do we go? Really from the outset, our conversation was that we could get care in healthcare, that the human factor could then be emphasized. Yeah. Since we are lacking that today, we don't have time, we don't have care, the humanity is diminished. Do you really think that ultimately when this is integrated into the future, that we will get back to the real relationship with the human to human bond?
I hope so. This is all speculation, like I try to repeat again and again, I don't predict anything, I speculate.
Right.
And it's very hard to say exactly what path things will follow. But 3 years ago, I was having a conversation with Jeff Flyer, who was then the dean of Howard Medical School. Mm-hmm. I said, you're selecting students for IQ. It's so hard to get into Stanford Med School or Howard Med School. You're selecting for IQ. I suggest, and this was 3 years ago, you change your admissions criteria to be the same as USC Film School. Why? Because that's where they select for mirror neurons, empathy, all the characteristics that at least for now, human beings, I suspect, will respond better with other human beings.
Yeah.
So I hope that happens. It's clear that emotional elements is at least an area for now that there isn't a clear, obvious path for machines to do as well as humans can. And frankly, humans should be trained more into that part of.
Well, I actually agree with you. There hasn't been a significant change in medical education since 100 years, the Flexner Report. And the idea that instead of relying on MCAT scores, that you rely on the person-to-person connection. You know, the fact that everyone, the master diagnostician will likely be, supplanted by algorithms.
Yeah, the doctor house will get in an AI bot, and everybody will have one free.
Right? Yeah.
But
the person-to-person bonding is a different story.
I think it's a very important part of it.
Well, I would love to talk to you for hours, but we don't want to keep everybody held up. But I say thank you. This has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank everybody who's tuned in to our one-on-one in Medscape that we've gotten some speculative ideas from a brilliant fellow, Vinod Khosla, and we look forward to many more interactions with you in the future. Thank you.